Mark Barr has written a novel, his first, called Watershed. His work is a historical fiction set in rural Tennessee in 1937, amid the construction of a monumental dam at the dawn of TVA and electric cooperatives providing power to people beyond cities for the first time. Tomorrow night, Mark will appear at Starline Books here in Chattanooga, starting at 6:30 p.m. for a public conversation about his novel. The other day, he stopped by Scenic Roots. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So how did you get the idea to write Watershed?
Back in the mid-90s, I was working in advertising. We had a client that was an electric cooperative. I had no idea what an electric cooperative was. I'd never heard of the thing. So I was researching for this brochure, and it just sort of blew my mind to discover this world that I hadn't known existed. It really stunned me that there'd been a 30 to 40 year period of time where we had electricity in the cities and yet not in the countryside. So we had, even though it was the 20th century, people in rural America were still living like it was the 1800s. It seemed like a great backdrop to a story. And so I set about researching and trying to think about how I would dramatize that.
And rural electrification, that took place in the 1930s as part of the New Deal. And one of the components of that was what we have here, TVA.
Right, yeah. The Rural Electrification Act was signed in 36, I guess. And yeah, and the TVA was all part of that. I was not as aware of the TVA. Every person in my world who had some Tennessee connection was quick to tell me about it. And so I knew early on that I would want to set the novel there then, because it seemed like such a sort of ripe countryside for the story.
Because you can tell the background details, but then you can also paint the characters against that background.
Yeah, because I think one of the challenges of writing the novel is that it's a story about a society in flux. And so there's both the macro and the micro levels. I mean, I think that's what's fascinating about it for me, is that these big stories, the stories of our country, of our national infrastructure, and those sorts of things are ultimately made up of people stories, of much smaller individual stories. That's where the real flavor is, I think. So the challenge was in sort of painting broad and fine brushstrokes, I guess.
So you set this novel in Hardin County,
mm-hmm.
and there are three characters, Claire, Hull, and Nathan.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about them.
Claire is a young rural housewife who's sort of out on her own for the first time, not by her choice. And she's coming to terms with her first brushes with what a career might feel like. I mean, she's someone who's grown up thinking her world will be one thing and it's become another. And so hers is largely a story of growth, of sort of overcoming these obstacles and blows she suffers early on in the novel and then growing. Nathan is an electrical engineer who is running from something in his past. It's not really clear what it is early in the book, but he is there under an assumed name, trying very desperately to sort of succeed. He wants to prove himself in the construction of this dam and succeed in getting on a more permanent basis. And then Hull is a salesman, originally from Chicago. He's probably the one who's been in this world the longest. His task is to sign people up for the cooperative. With the establishment of the Rural Electrification Administration, and I guess with the TVA, the government was blocked from selling electricity directly to individuals, so they formed these cooperatives that would then purchase the wholesale electricity and then turn around and then provide it to their member owners. And so Hull's job is to go about and sign people up, take people who've never had electricity and convince them that it's worth their effort to make the change. And he enlists Claire to help him.
And with that, I think it's time to hear a little bit from the novel.
Terrific. So this is from early in the book. This is Nathan's arrival in town at the boarding house where he's going to stay while he's working. The boarding house lady had been vexed when Nathan showed up on her porch that night. But after a few muttered complaints, she led him upstairs to a cramped room under the eaves. The room had a small table that he saw at once he could employ as a desk, but the lone lamp that lit the space was small and dim. He made a mental note to ask about getting another, but didn't press his position, having only just gotten her to agree to letting him in. He pushed his suitcase into a corner and stretched himself out on the thin mattress. In a moment, he was asleep. At dawn, he was up and shaved in the sink of the shared hall bathroom. He had only the two suits, and the one he'd worn the day before showed every step he'd taken on the road from Memphis. He traded his rumpled suit for the one in the case, splashed on cologne, and buffed his shoes with his old socks. The boarding house woman, Irma, met him at the bottom of the stairs. "You're an early one," she said, her tone revealing nothing about whether she approved or disapproved of this trait. "I've seen the map. It's a long walk to the dam site," he said. He was wearing his hat. When he caught her frowning at it, he slipped it off. "Sit down," she said. "You're too early for most of it. The biscuits just went in. But I'll scramble you an egg. I hear tell there's a truck that runs out to the site from the drugstore." "Thanks. I'll go down there and wait. I can't afford to..." "Sit down," Irma said. "You men don't have enough sense to know you have to eat." She took his hat from him and hung it on a peg near the door. He eased into the chair she had pointed at, and she disappeared into the next room. In a moment she was back, setting a plate before him. She had a pot of coffee that she poured without asking. He sat back to make conversation, but she left again. When he was nearly finished, she returned with a leather-bound volume that she opened on the table. She took a short pencil from her apron pocket and readied it at the top of the page. "Full name," she said. Nathan, he said, then swallowed. "Nathan McCreakin." She cut her eyes at him and he coughed, took a sip from his coffee. "How long a stay?" she said. "I'm not sure. I suppose that depends." "Week to week, then," she said. "Rent's due every Monday." She closed the book and carried it into the next room. He ate the last of his eggs and took his plate and cup into the kitchen. "Well, I'll be," she said, and chuckled at his manners. She took the plate from him and placed it in the sink. When she turned to face him once again, her face was sober. "I don't have many rules here, but I'm serious about the few I have. The first is keep quiet after dark. I won't have you bothering the other boarders. The second is no drinking. I don't like it. I've got enough troubles with a household of men without trying to wrangle a bunch of drunks. You think you can remember those two rules?" He ducked his head. "Yes, ma'am, I believe I can." "Well, good," she said. She went to the doorway and peered at the grandfather clock that stood in one corner of the dining room. "Now get going, and I suspect you'll still be able to catch that truck."
And there's his arrival, and there's one thread of the story right there.
Right, yeah.
I'm struck by how, with the individual characters, and then also the big picture, this is at a time where the country is changing. The South is becoming less agrarian and more like what we see today.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not an easy story to tell. There are very difficult parts of it to tell. The whole thing with the TVA, I'm reminded of other fiction where you have progress and you have a natural resource and you have people trying to navigate changes. I think further west to Los Angeles and to Chinatown, which was a movie set in the 1930s, and water was the theme there.
Right, right. The 30s, I think, were a kind of a pivotal moment in our history as we were coming out of the Depression and moving into that sort of expansion that ultimately would come out of World War II. We sort of manufacture our way out of the war almost. And it really was a time we were really starting to capitalize on resources. And at the same time, there was a lot of, as you say, there were some very difficult times as we struggled with the needs of the many or the need versus the needs of the individual. I mean, we were a country of individuals. So it was, I think, a pretty difficult time.
What would you like people to take away from this story?
I think ultimately it is an optimistic story. It is a positive sort of outlook on things. I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. Ultimately, it's a story of Claire and her growth. I feel like that is the main thrust of the book, is sort of a positive one, a story of overcoming difficulties and through determination and hard work, rising to the occasion and succeeding.
But through a lens that people reading today, you might hope, would recognize.
Yeah, definitely. I hope so. I think that's certainly an attraction of historical fiction to me. I love the idea of capturing a past time. Ultimately, I don't know what people's lives were like then. I've researched, but ultimately it comes down to my imagination. But what drew me to this story was, one, the idea of it's something big I felt in our past a lot of us don't know about, and I wanted to kind of dramatize that. But I would hope, yeah, that there's just a sense of what people's lives were like in that time, that people will come away feeling like they've sort of at best glimpsed a little of what life might have been like. Today, our lives are so modernized and so comfortable for us as we sit here in air conditioning and with electric lights and talk on the radio. I just came across the country driving in my car and climate control, automatic transmission, everything. It's amazing how hard some of these people's lives were, and yet how resistant some of them were to let go of those lives. and try something new. And I wanted to capture what that transformation was like, I think.
Well, let's hear another sample from the novel that captures that.
Okay. I think next I'd like to read one of the red-haired boy sections. They're about six or seven throughout the book. They serve to sort of portray, how to put it, they are the face of the town. The red-haired boy and his family sort of stand in as the every family sort of aspect, separate from the drama, the particular drama of Nathan and Claire and Hull. But I think they capture some of the flavor of the time and what I was trying to do with the novel. The red-haired boy was walking home from Tom's when he spotted his father's car among three or four others parked along the side of McPherson's barn. He'd worried that he was running late and that he'd get it for being tardy for supper. But if his father wasn't home yet, then the meal would still be waiting. He smiled at the unexpected reprieve, cutting across the rows towards the barn, careful to step between the plants. The sun was failing. The sky to the west across the road was still painted orange, but in the lee of the barn, the shadows were deepening. It took him a moment to find his father among the other field laborers, sharing beers and talk now that the day was ending. They'd been shoveling a load of cottonseed from the back of a truck into the barn, where tarps had been spread on the floor. The men sat and leaned on shovels around the barn's opening. They were the ones that had hired on. Along the edge of the property, a line of transmission poles had recently gone up and was ready to be strung with wire. It was towards these poles that the men were looking as John slipped up unnoticed. "They'd run out clear past the east corner of our place," his father was saying. "Dorothy's already asking for an automatic washing machine and an electric stove." "A new excuse to spend money," another of the men said. "What I'd like to know," said a third, "is where that money's going to come from. You think once McPherson has pumps and such, he's going to need us? I haven't seen it, but you can sure as bet there's a contraption that'll move cottonseed into the barn for him." "Oh, there'll always be something for a man to do," said another. "Scraps," said the man. "You'll be picking up scraps of whatever work the machines can't do." "Grumbling about it won't stop things. Government's set on forcing electricity on us whether we want it or not." "What do you aim to do, fight 'em?" "Believe me, you don't want that sort of trouble. They got lawyers that don't need a gun to same as kill you. They can take our land." "Just let them try," the man said. His face had gone hard, and he looked from man to man around the circle, as if challenging them in the government's stead. "Easy there, Jim," said another, and made things easy with a laugh. "Electricity, electricity, electricity. I'm tired of hearing about it. Have another beer, and let's talk about something else." The men let the topic slide and went back to brooding over their beers. His father turned to toss his empty bottle into the barrel that stood near the barn door. As he stretched to reach another, the boy stepped forward. "Hey, Daddy," he said. Seeing him, his father seemed to realize how late it was. He stood, dusting off his pants. "I'll see you guys tomorrow," he said. "Come on, John. I expect your mother will be wondering where we are." His father was playful on the walk to the car. He tousled the boy's hair. "Your ma's liable to be put out with us," he said. "Let's not say anything about that beer back there, okay?" He flashed his son a grin. When they got to the car, he let him crank the starter. The boy watched his father as they drove the dirt lane back towards their house. He looked tired from the day's work. His father, he knew, was excited about the electricity. He wondered why he hadn't spoken up, why the others had seemed so angry. It seemed to him that only good things were coming with the power lines. He was young. He didn't and couldn't know how the change scared them. The boy would take to electricity the way the young always take to new technologies. He'd accepted at face value, seeing no deeper import because he hadn't spent decades living in a world without it.
We've lived that last sentence several times since.
Yeah, whether it's our new digital watches or our smartphones, I guess.
How challenging was it to capture that time and this place without falling into, I read this or saw this elsewhere, or I'm hitting cliche territory?
Right, I think that was a real challenge of the work. Early on in sort of researching novels that had already been written in this area, I came across at least one that dealt with what was a major function of the time, which was the eminent domain of private land, mostly with the flooding of valleys when dams were created. And so I made a decision to avoid that, not because it was controversial, because I felt like someone had already kind of written that novel and I was new enough in my process that I thought I didn't want to like risk rewriting something. I don't know. I took a really long time to write the book. So I think for all the drawbacks of that, it did have the obvious benefit of allowing me to revise, which meant I could go back and if I felt like something was a bit too on the nose or something we were a little too over familiar with, I could then revise and try to approach it from a new angle or find a fresher sort of look at it, I guess.
How long did it take you?
All in all, I spent about 12 active years over a 20-year period.
Had you set out to take that long?
I definitely had not. I think what happened was I knew a novel was going to be a long process. I knew it was not a sprint, it was a marathon. And so I think I cut myself some slack. I felt like as long as I was working, I felt like you're doing okay. You don't have to beat yourself up too much. But somehow a decade passed, and it was really about then that I realized, I've got to actually think about how I'm going to finish this. And I began to set daily quotas. That seemed to really move things along a lot better.
And you're traveling around talking about this book. What's ahead?
My next book is set during World War II. It's set in Austria. And I'm looking at a couple of characters. They are cousins, Austrians in the German army. One is a rocketry scientist, and the other is a linguist. And they are involved in a love triangle with an American expat, a lovely woman who's come over from America.
And I'm guessing the goal is not 12 years, but you're just starting?
No, I have about half of it written. Okay. So I would hope, I'm famously bad at predicting these things. Throughout my 12 years, I always thought I was just maybe the next year, and then it'd suddenly be the new year. And I think I was really wrong about that. So my hope is in the next couple of years to have this wrapped up, revised and polished, ready to go.
And beyond the event here in Chattanooga, how can people follow you online?
I have a website, readmarkbar.com, readmarkbar, all one word. It's my author site. I have some posted reviews, events, so you can find out where I'm going to be next, things like that.
All right. Mark, thank you. All the best.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.